I try to be optimistic and I try to say, okay, I have treated patients like you that we try some of the same things or try to layer on prevention and see where we can get. You know, I'll encourage them to go to some of these centers where maybe they can get DHE and have the headache broken, and have a multidisciplinary approach, you know, have psychiatry involved, probably pain medicine as well, and just try to, you know, get to a place that's maybe not no pain, but like functional, you know, better.
For many people with frequent migraine symptoms, it can feel like the nervous system is permanently on overdrive. Even small triggers can set off big reactions. And while lifestyle or behavioral strategies are often recommended, they don't always work when your system is already on high alert. What if these tools are failing you because your system just isn't ready for them? What if medication isn't just about symptom relief, but about letting the migraine system reset so that other approaches like sleep, exercise, and other supportive measures can finally take effect? Joining us to explain this foundational reset model is Dr. Risa Ravitz. She is a headache specialist, board certified in both neurology and pain medicine. Dr. Ravitz, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you for having me.
You often note the challenge of treating chronic migraine when our brains are already so sensitized. Can you explain what that means in brain science terms and why it makes it so difficult to try to treat the problem?
This is a problem that's not so well understood, obviously, honestly. And a lot of this data comes from newer migraine models, but also comes from pain medicine, where we're starting to learn that the body and the brain and the spinal cord are like a separate, not a separate, but they're like almost like a hard drive that interacts with the peripheral system that will have changes within that hard drive that change the threshold for having pain and will sort of change the baseline, so to speak, of how pain is felt and perceived and experienced. I think a hard drive is sort of a nice way to think about it, where those signals and the sort of intermediary information processing gets too excitatory and recruits other neurons, and it becomes also a little bit broken.
Is the overprocessing, does that affect all areas of our brain, or is it specifically with the pain pathways?
The brain is like almost like a muscle, and the circuits that are used more and more get stronger and stronger. Those connections get stronger. The dendrites and connections, they make stronger and stronger connections. So the pain response will get stronger within the spinal cord. That happens too. We know that in the base of the brain as well, there'll be more stronger signaling. And then there's downstream effects with things like migraine, like autonomic type phenomenon that we see where people have more of those symptoms. And one of the more interesting things that I see is that pain tends to make pain. So if I have a patient who has migraine and starts to become more chronic, other pain that's really far away from the head starts to trigger migraine. So like, for example, they may have back pain, and that pain may be completely separate from migraine, but then as the migraine becomes more chronic and the pain, the low back pain becomes more chronic, they seem to feed off each other, so to speak.
Is that only for chronic pain, or does that also work with acute pain on top of migraine?
For acute pain, it shouldn't. It shouldn't. The system is, we were developed, you know, the model is, you know, you put your hand on a hot stove, you have a reflex to pull it back. The signal is done. Everything goes back to baseline. When you have something that's repeated where there's no injury, right, or no technical injury, like if you break an arm or you have appendicitis or something like that, there's a reason that you're having that pain. With things like chronic migraine, things like chronic low back pain, there isn't often this exact mechanistic reason for it to happen. And it's much more typical that pain tends to make pain over and over.
And so it's not just if we have lower back pain and migraine, it's also if we have migraine and perhaps we're more prone to developing lower back pain or a different area like that?
So it's not necessarily prone, but I do think that more chronic pain patients have pain that develop in many places, unfortunately. So like neck pain, low back pain, you know, they have these catch-all terms like fibromyalgia and these things that we don't quite, or chronic pain syndrome, where we don't understand, where a normal stimulus will just set someone off and they'll have pain for days and days and days that's way out of the normal reaction to pain.
How exactly does pharmacology act as a reset button for the system?
There's different targets. So one of the problems is that we don't understand this exactly. We see different places where we can interfere and try to cut off some of those things. But, you know, from the periphery, from the, let's say, from the hand or the leg or the face or the neck, all the way, it goes all the way through the spinal cord and up into the brain. There's many connections that are happening, and there's many different targets that we're trying to hit. So each of the ways that we try to use to treat migraine, yes, they're for migraine, but a lot of it is to try to reduce that excitation and reduce that pain signaling.
Why do behavioral and lifestyle changes not often work and sometimes even backfire when we're trying to treat a very highly sensitized system?
I have a lot of migraine patients, and I suffer from migraine myself. And for a long time, you know, so it was like, and I like to exercise and I like to be active. There was very specific movements that I would do. So I like to surf, and there's very specific movements, like even just simple things like putting my wetsuit on and reaching up over my head sometimes would like pull in an area that would just trick, it would just, I knew it was just like, okay, this is going to trigger this thing. So I hear that a lot. Interestingly, in a lot of female patients, a lot of migraine patients are females, but it tends to, like, I think we have weaker mid and upper backs. We don't work on that so much. And we tend to do like more cardio and yoga and things that we don't strengthen our mid and upper backs. And I think that those, like, we need to do that before we can do some of the more intensive exercises that is good for migraine. So the data shows that, you know, cardio is probably the best thing for migraine, like moderate cardio a few days a week. But I've also found that for myself personally and for my patients, we have to kind of build through and build strength in places that are weak, because a lot of patients will actually get migraines from exercise. So part of it is retraining the musculoskeletal system to support everything, so there isn't like a pain trigger. A lot of people in chronic pain are in so much pain that they can't take the next step. So it's this vicious cycle of, you know, I need to lay down in a dark, quiet room, and, you know, then I get this pain here and it lasts for days and days. So, you know, it has to work. So one of the things I try to do with medicines is like give people enough relief that they can start to do these things again and kind of retrain and get back to their lives, you know, or get stronger, you know, and build.
I just feel like that's really validating to hear. I feel like, you know, exercise especially is, and nutrition are, we're constantly told about that. And for someone with daily migraine where it's really tough to even get out of bed, it sort of adds an extra layer of guilt and shame and, oh, I should be doing more. And how am I possibly supposed to be out exercising?
Yeah. And I think from the food perspective, you know, that's something that people are constantly asking me about. There are some very specific food triggers. They tend to be dehydration. And then there's specific foods like MSG, which is a strong preservative. Sulfites and tannins tends to be in like aged meats and wine. So some of those preservatives tend to be very migrainogenic, I guess you could call it. But then there's people that tell me, you know, I've done a food diary, and that causality is so hard to pinpoint. So I obviously tell people, you know, if every time you eat avocado, you get a headache, maybe avoid avocado. But the truth is, we don't know if you're craving avocado and then you eat it and you get a migraine. I've had some patients that have had some success with like a ketogenic diet. It's a very hard diet. And I think one of the things that's hard about migraine and lifestyle is that it becomes such a rigid exercise. And I don't like that. You know, I don't like when things get so rigid. It's not sustainable, and it's not like living your life. So I try to work with people on that and not have them focus so much on that.
For some patients, it can be intimidating to start a preventative medication because they see it as a life sentence. What advice would you give to them?
I have patients that, you know, I have to convince them to take medicine. Like maybe they're having, let's say, 8 headache days a month, or 8 to 12. That's a common one of days of headache, not necessarily maybe that many headaches, but headache days. So that's pretty significant, right? And I finally convince them to try something preventative, you know, not forever, just to see if it'll do something. And what happens in the good cases is they come back to me and they say, you know what? I had almost no headaches and I forgot what this feels like. So all the behavioral stuff that they were focused on or like really rigid about kind of went to the wayside, and now they're feeling better. And they're like, okay, I'm not going to go drinking yet, but like I'm going to try to, you know, go back to the gym, you know? So I think it's great if you can do both, but a lot of times people are, you know, the more chronic ones are sort of already having a lot of trouble.
You don't have to take it in all at once. You can return to extended interviews at your own pace with the All Access Pass.
So we talked a lot about the central versus peripheral system, and I know that different treatments, some will primarily target one or the other. Could you go over some examples that mostly target the central and mostly target the peripheral?
A good example of a medicine that's mostly central targeting is like a tricyclic antidepressant. And at low doses, these medicines target the spinal neurons more in the base of the brain. So there's receptors in those areas that are better. That's the target, and the pain reduction comes from that. So then, if you look at something like calcium channel blockers or beta blockers, there's some idea that they actually work by decreasing excitation in blood vessels in the brain, but they're also doing it in the periphery. So again, it's like, is that reducing some sort of autonomic sympathetic response? Probably. Botox is technically delivered peripherally. So the actual place where it's blocking the nerves from talking to each other, from propagating those pain signals, is peripheral. But we think that it's somehow being integrated and doing something to the signaling inside the brain. Is it stopping it right at the scalp? Maybe. The gepants, these newer medicines, tend to be more centrally. Well, actually, they work in the trigeminal nerve, so that's technically peripheral as well. So there's different places that we think those both work. So there's a lot of feedback loops within the brain that's technically like central. You know, those neurons that are deep in the spinal cord in the base of the brain, those are technically central, but there's a lot of overlap.
For acute treatments, if someone is really struggling to find a medication that works for them, they have an acute medication that sort of works, what complementary therapies would you suggest adding to that first?
So I would say ice. Definitely ice is quick, easy, and dirty. I think, you know, if there's no contraindications to anti-inflammatories, things like Advil, Aleve, those are always good. Interestingly, I use Benadryl too. So Benadryl is an antihistamine, and histamine is a neurotransmitter that's intimately involved in migraine propagation. So will make you tired, but that's a nice quick cocktail. And then, you know, people can add caffeine to that. So you get the tired and plus the caffeine, but caffeine works similarly to the triptan. So it will constrict the blood vessels and often help right away. So I think those are probably the easiest, quickest, safest, dirtiest ones that often work.
All right, let's go to migraine prevention. When you're looking to reset the system, which pharmaceutical classes do you tend to start with, and which ones are good to combine? And are there other ones that you do not ever want to combine?
If there's a medical problem, another medical problem like high blood pressure or insomnia or depression, maybe I'm going to think about a hypertensive medicine, something that's good for sleep, or something that will help with depression as well, to sort of kill two birds with one stone and sort of think about that. So many people have insomnia just in general for as like a modern problem, but also I think when you have migraines, sometimes it's hard to sleep. So sometimes I'll pick some, if that's a big issue, that's probably contributing to the migraine, to migraines. And I may pick something like that first. So I may pick a tricyclic antidepressant or something like gabapentin to sort of cover that. If there's hypertension, it's untreated, or there's room to sort of go up in that, the beta blockers and calcium channel blockers are good for that. Otherwise, the newer medicines in general are a little bit cleaner than the older ones, just a little bit. They still have their side effects, and some people don't tolerate them. But they tend to not interact with a lot of medications, and they've been pretty effective. So I'll sort of reach for those quickly first as well. So things like the seizure medicines, those are really good medicines too, but some people react very poorly to those. So it's more like, will the insurance pay for it? Is the patient willing to take it? And how many side effects are they going to potentially have? And it's sort of moving, if there's that doesn't work, moving to the next thing. And those are real practical things. You know, it's sort of, will it be paid for? Will they be able to get it? And how well will they tolerate it? So that's sort of how I do it, how I choose things. And over the years, I kind of learned, some patterns. You tend to see a lot of patients and then see patterns. It's interesting. Like, I think it's things like Topamax and some of these other seizure medicines, they often work in like young females, interestingly. I'm not sure why. And same thing with propranolol. Propranolol tends to not be as well tolerated in males. There's some sexual side effects. Also, they feel tired. So there's like little tricks that will just try different things, but it's not a 100, not even close to 100% like good first try often. You know, it's often trial and error. As far as combining, many of them you can combine, truthfully. There's a few that have some contraindications when you're on other medications, like high doses of antidepressants, for example. But generally, the migraine doses are kind of low, and they generally you can use those for a lot of different things. And then things like, Botox, there's very few contraindications to Botox. So that's a good one, like for somebody who's refractory and also has a lot of medications on board already.
One of the therapies you offer at your clinic is radiofrequency ablation for migraine. Can you explain how that works?
So I don't actually do that. I have colleagues that do that. I did a little bit of training in interventional pain procedures, but just didn't make it a part of my practice. But I have colleagues that do it, and I definitely will send patients to get that done as well. So basically, the median facet, like there's a nerve that's in the joint between the between the bones and the spine, and it's a real joint. That nerve can really be activated and cause a lot of pain in the neck, but in the higher part of the neck, it connects up eventually into the occipital nerve up in here, and that nerve is really problematic for chronic neck pain and people that have facet arthropathy, which is very common. It's like just basically wear and tear in the neck and in the upper back. So what we'll do sometimes is send patients, if they have a lot of neck pain and a lot of facet arthropathy, we'll send them to get epidurals first in that area to see if they actually, like, numbing it will quiet things down. And if that works even a little bit, we've had some success with higher cervical radio frequency ablations, where it's basically they go in and try to just burn that nerve. It can cause like soreness and tightness, but it can offer relief. I've had patients that have had relief for like 6+ months, which is really awesome. Yeah. And with the right patient, sometimes with a combination of medicine, sometimes without, it's a really good intervention. That needs to be done under fluoroscopy. So it's guided with X-ray. So you have to go to a place that they can do that. But it's a reasonable thing to try.
And after that 6-month period, are you able to get it done again? Is it sort of like nerve blocks in that respect?
Yes. It lasts longer than nerve blocks. But of course, the nerves figure out a way to grow, like, propagate pain. It's interesting. But you could do it every 6 months. People often, they're successful with it. It's often longer than that, honestly, like once a year, maybe. It's a good one. It's definitely a good one.
So with the pharmaceutical reset, so that the behavioral therapies are able to work better, how long would you say that generally lasts when, you know, someone comes to you, they're probably already tried many things. They're already pretty far along in their journey. How long would it typically take?
My line is that, you know, forever's a long time. And God willing, that will be a long life. And I do not want people on medicine forever. It's long. The patients that are very refractory are so used to being on medicine that it's often sort of like a fait accompli and sort of rotating and adding and layering on prevention. But for other patients that maybe are on one or two preventatives, I usually tell them, let's try and get your headaches under control for 6 months. It's not set in stone. If you hate it, we can stop it. It's not something we have to do. But I like to have people under good control for a good 6 months. Like a year is even better, you know, depending on what they want in their life, going to get pregnant, you know, that kind of thing. But I feel like the longer it's reset, the better off you are. And then I have a whole bunch of different outcomes. It's interesting. So I have people that maybe will try prevention for a month, and then maybe they had headaches for like a bunch of, like, maybe they got a headache. It lasted for 6 weeks, let's say, which is seemingly more and more common than I'm seeing. So they'll start the prevention. Yeah. They'll start the prevention and then they'll feel better in a month and then they'll stop it. And I don't hear from them until the next time it happens, maybe like a year later or 2 years later. Then there's the people that have had, like, I would say 4 to 6 migraines, and they just started prevention. Those people, I want it on them for 6 months, and then we sort of wean and see what happens. I would say a good portion of them don't need to go back on right away. Some of them, it starts to pop through and they're like, I don't want to have this anymore. And now I lived my life without it and I want to feel better. And then there's some people that do it for longer and, you know, go off the medicine and then they're headache free for a while. So it's a very mixed bag and a very individualized, and I can almost never predict like how it's going to go.
Do you have any recommendations for patients who are trying to get a balance of both and they have providers who aren't really willing to talk about it?
In general, I think doctors, as they start to progress through working and seeing patients, it's not black and white at all. Like, not even a little bit. Even things that should be very straightforward, like you have an infection, treat it, sometimes they're not so straightforward. And pain is even a wider berth of gray, if that makes sense. So for me personally, I feel like we really don't know a lot. Like there's a lot that we know, but there's so much that we don't know. But I do, I understand the sort of journey of the patient. It's not easy, and there's a lot of information available. And also migraine and pain is like, it's not so predictable. It's like, oh yes, I did it this time and it worked great. And then it didn't. And I did everything right and I still got it, and, you know, and it's hard. So You know, my goal is like, I want patients to know that they have nothing seriously wrong with them. So we do a workup. I want them to know there's things we can do to try to prevent and also treat acutely. And I think there's other lifestyle things they can do that will make their headaches better. So just kind of offering the whole gamut is where I'm at. But it's starting to, like I said, it's starting to encompass things that I have to do more research on and I'm not sure about. So things like extensive functional medicine testing, ketamine, you know, these mushrooms, like there's so many questions I'm getting now that we don't have studies on, and I'm not sure that it's not really harmful. You know, marijuana, I'm not sure. And I do worry that it's potentially harmful.
I want to get your perspective as you're board certified in both neurology and pain medicine. How closely do you see migraine as a chronic pain condition? And especially when you're trying to reset the system, like through pharmaceuticals, is treating migraine almost exactly like treating general chronic pain?
Yes. So the answer to that in my mind is yes. I think it is very much like a chronic pain thing. I think what's interesting is how it evolved. So it kind of was like not in the pain realm. So when you study pain, like the way that evolved was through anesthesia, basically. They did a lot of the studies, interestingly, which is really cool. And they were working on things like blocks, like in trauma patients. They would do these blocks and then they would start to work on complex regional pain, like things that were like post-traumatic that became chronic that we didn't understand why. And then you have neurology, which basically like totally different kind of evolution. And, you know, migraine was barely even recognized like in the 60s as like, you know, then there were these auras and hysteria and all these things. So it was sort of like they were evolving separately, but I think that they're actually very similar. Whether this becomes peripheral, central, how it manifests is like another pain thing, another pain process. So what I'm seeing now is that a lot of pain doctors are treating migraine, which is great. You know, they're doing radiofrequency ablations, they're doing Botox, they're doing a lot of the pain medicines that will cover both, you know, chronic pain. Things like tricyclic antidepressants, nerve pain medicines, SNRIs, like those types of medicines they're using a lot of. They're a little less comfortable maybe with like the seizure medicines, and but they're good. They're intent, like they're good doctors they're learning and they're using the new medicines as well. So I'm seeing a lot of people treating migraine patients. And the truth is a lot of chronic pain patients have migraines. So many of them will try to treat themselves, like the headaches. It's not true the other way around, interestingly. So like a lot of neurologists become like headache specialists and they won't deal with other pain, which like they'll think about it. If like the person has neck pain or again, they can't sleep, they might think of something that might work, but they're not going to get into the nitty gritty of it. And when you go to the different societies to like take the tests and learning, it's still like a different, it's not completely different, but the science is like not totally, you know, coalesced yet. But I think it's very similar, sort of looking at both.
What do you tell patients who feel like nothing works, they've been chronic for decades, and they feel like their system is too broken to ever be able to fix?
You know, definitely a portion of my practice, I try to be optimistic and I try to say, okay, I have treated patients like you that we try some of the same things or try to layer on prevention and see where we can get, you know, I'll encourage them to go to some of these centers where maybe they can get DHE and have the headache broken, and have a multidisciplinary approach, you know, have psychiatry involved, probably pain medicine as well, and just try to, you know, get to a place that's maybe not no pain, but like functional, you know, better.
Are there any new studies or research or areas that you are really excited for patients who want to do a more holistic approach to migraine?
I like this whole notion of like building mid and upper back strength and sort of working through pain. I like the idea of exercise through pain. It creates its own natural pain fighters and will also help to reset like an imprint in the brain. So I like that a lot, and I work closely with some physical therapists that I'm excited about that. It's just, will patients do it? Will the insurance pay for it? You know, all the normal stuff. But that's probably what I'm most excited about.
Where can we follow your work and learn more about what you're doing?
Oh, I don't really write anything. I actually was thinking, I was doing a little bit of a podcast, which no time, but it's called The Rabbit's Way. There's a couple episodes on there that are kind of interesting. It's on YouTube and Spotify. But yeah, I don't have any other thing in the works right now.
All right, great. Well, Dr. Rabbits, thank you so much for being on the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you for having me. Hope it was helpful.
Definitely was.